Select your program.
Dialogue.
Program initiated.
Approach the threshold. Engage rationality. Open your mind. Godspeed.
Hello, everybody. Danny Boy joining you without Michael today. And we have a special guest, Matt Sands. And he is a longtime listener to the show, always providing some valuable feedback. And we thought, you know what? Let's just get this guy on. He has many useful ideas and perhaps critiques of maybe the fuzzy edges of voluntarism, aka anarcho-capitalism, and some ideas on how, you know, we may fill in the gaps, especially to those outside who are kind of unsure of the complicated inner workings, or how we would deal with some potentially more difficult situations. So Matt is also associated with I don't want to call it a program, but an idea called the Nations of Sanity. So without further ado, Matt, welcome on, and tell us a little bit about yourself as well as this Nations of Sanity idea.
Thanks, Dan. Basically, the Nations of Sanity, I call it a movement, but it probably doesn't qualify, as it's not quite achieved the size of what you'd normally associate with a movement. But, I mean, basically what it is, it's presenting the ideas of a free society, as most anarcho-capitalists would. But it's just attempting to sort of doing it in a little bit more of a concrete way, in a bit of a way where it kind of, deals with the practicalities involved rather than just, the moral argument. I'm an anarchist myself. One sort of flaw I find that other anarchists have is we're all very content with winning the moral argument when it comes to talking about government and free society and the non-aggression principle. But when it comes to deal with the actual practicalities and some of the questions on how this would work in the real world, that's when we're a little bit short of answers sometimes. And the Nations of Sanity is attempting to sort of explore those murky areas that haven't been clarified as of yet, and kind of present a path to a free society, as well as a description of what a free society would actually be, what it involves. Obviously, one sort of thing that a lot of us have to try and do is make people understand what a free society really involves. Especially when you talk about anarchism, people will always think of lawlessness and chaos and things like that. And obviously, you know, particularly anarcho-capitalists, you know, we know that anarchism isn't about no rulers, it's about but about no rulers. And that's the difference. You can still have rules, in my opinion, the only rules that you can have in a free society that can actually be law would be laws that are based on the non-aggression principle, because you don't need the authority to rule over people to enforce the non-aggression principle, because obviously the non-aggression principle is literally just prohibiting you from causing harm or loss to another. So you don't need the ability to rule over somebody to enforce that kind of law, because you're literally just defending yourself or defending others. And as you and Mike have obviously discussed in podcasts in the past, the non-aggression principle isn't a pacifist principle, as some people sometimes think. It is actually a principle that's based on saying that you cannot initiate force, but you can still use force to defend yourself, and you can still use force to defend others. And based on that, we could still have a society where we have law, but the only things that would be crimes would be violations of the non-aggression principle. And that's kind of the free society that the Nations of Sanity presents just clarifies, you know, this is what the non-aggression principle is about. This is what it would mean to have a society where, that, you know, that is what we would describe as a free society, where the non-aggression principle is the only law. And that basically provides the freedom that people have. And in my opinion, also a true sense of equality. And I mean, not equality of outcome, but true equality, as in everyone has the same rights. Everyone has the same freedom. Because the non-aggression principle just is completely across the board. It's universal and it's an objective standard.
So I like what I hear so far. So basically the Nations of Sanity, it's you're outlining a framework of how you see these things being applied in the real world, more or less. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah. Basically, the Nations of Sanity is split up into two parts, which we're very clear to sort of distinguish the two parts. We have one part is what we demand, and that is to have the non-aggression principle basically be the law of society. And then we have what we suggest, like our proposals, because I think we need to provide ideas, as I say, like practical answers, but they might not necessarily be the answers. We just want to show that a free society can work. So when people say, what would you do about this? And how would this work? And how would this work? We have all these ideas of, well, you can, you know, like some people, just to give you an example, the favorite question that obviously people get when you talk about the fact that, because obviously a free society, you can't have taxation because taxation is theft. So the obvious question people have is, well, you know, what about all these services that we get from government? What about all the infrastructure? You know, how would you not only like, for example, I talked about how you can still have law. So you could still have a police force, for want of a better word, that would enforce that law as long as the law is consistent with the non-aggression principle. But then the obvious question is, okay, well, how would you fund that? If it's not going to be a private police force and it's going to serve the public, how would you fund that if you're not going to have taxation? And the Nations of Sanity provides some voluntary methods of doing so. One of the things that's suggested, for example, is using the regulated market to fund quote unquote public services. So, we have a regulated market right now. Which is currently regulated by government, and taxation is applied to the regulated trade in the form of duty taxes. I don't know what they're called in the US. They're called VAT over here in England. Would you know them as duty taxes?
I suppose we call them sales tax over here, I think.
Yeah. But you know what I'm referring to anyway. But basically, one of the ideas, and again, this is a proposal, this is part of the proposals, not part of the demands. But one of the ideas is to continue the regulated market, and to continue to apply this sort of tax, but it wouldn't be a tax anymore. And the reason why it wouldn't be a tax anymore is because it would no longer be compulsory to use the regulated market. Like if people wanted to trade through unregulated, they can do that. What's currently the black market would no longer be the black market. It would just be the unregulated market, and people would have a choice. But if they're going to use the regulated market, then there's going to be an additional cost applied to their trade, which would be what's currently duty taxes. It would probably be more of a regulation fee. And because use of the regulated market itself isn't mandatory, it would no longer qualify as a tax. It would just be a fee that you're paying for the service. You're using the regulated market. Just like now, government could argue that the taxes we pay is to pay for the regulation of the market, although it also pays in part for government. But the problem is people don't have a choice about whether they use the regulated market. And that's what makes the fees that apply to it taxation. And that's what makes them immoral. So, I mean, that's just one example of a practical solution that's offered. And it's not, like I say, it's not what's demanded. These are just, we just feel that if we're going to make demands about the non-aggression principle and about the fact that we want true freedom and a free society, then when people ask questions of, oh, well, how would you have this? How would you have that? I think it's important that we provide potential solutions and potential answers to those questions. So when people say, well, how would you fund a police force that that's not, you know, that's not a private organization like a private security firm. Well, there's one option for you. You can retain the regulated market. It can be the entity that runs it can be very much government-like in regards to regulating the market and providing certain basic services to the public, like police. But the difference is it would run more like a private organization in respect of it wouldn't have any authority to rule over people, and it would... You know, it would be a voluntary, you know, it would be something you would use voluntary. It wouldn't be something you're obliged to use. Mm-hmm.
So, okay, I have a couple of specific questions, but
yeah.
Real quick before we get into that, whenever I hear the word nation or country, I immediately think, oh, state government, you know, I don't want that. That sounds like statism to me. So help me understand what the appeal of the word nation or nations is. I may be misunderstanding. Maybe it's just a word with, you know, you're not obviously not implying a compulsory state. So what is the meaning behind that? Would there be voluntary states? I mean, to me, that sounds like a contradiction, but help me understand the concept when you use the word nation in this
okay, yeah.
Nations of Sanity.
Well, funnily enough, you're not the first person to make that point, and it does make me wonder whether the Nations of Sanity, perhaps that's a flaw in the name that it, you know, that it sort of conjures that kind of imagery in people's minds. I mean, the thinking behind it was really just about, you know, people have national identity. I mean, I'm not a particularly nationalistic person. But, you know, a lot of people do, you know, they identify as English or American, whatever their nationality is, just as they might identify by their race or religion or various other things. Mm. This was really the whole idea of calling it Nations of Sanity was basically because it's trying to create a sort of united people under the banner of sanity. It's kind of saying rather than being. I mean, I suppose the name's similar, if you like, in format to the Nations of Islam. And because the Nations of Islam is basically, you know, the premise of that is that it's all people uniting under the ethos of Islam. The Nations of Sanity is really just kind of saying, trying to represent a united people that are uniting under the banner of sanity. That's because, I mean, the whole, it's more about, the word sanity is the more important word in the title of the movement. It's more about saying what we're representing, because we're not representing a utopia. We're not saying this will make a perfect world. This is, we want a perfect society or a society that's in line with our personal preferences. We're really presenting a free society as a sane society. We're basically saying, look, the society, the systems that we live under now, as well as being immoral, they're not really sane. They don't have any consistent logic that even qualifies as sane. So we're kind of bringing it all back. And the whole idea of the Nations of Sanity is basically trying to create a brotherhood of people that are united under the banner of this sanity that we define by the non-aggression principle.
Got it. Yeah, it does. And I suppose people could still, you know, have geographical, boundaries and, identities, so to speak, you know, even in a stateless society, like, hey, I'm Russian or, you know, maybe smaller countries. I don't know. You probably see borders dissolving, but I'm African, I'm Asian, et cetera. But in any case, it does sound like a useful mechanism to make that horse pill a little easier for some people to swallow. You know, you're transitioning from a very different paradigm. So anything to help sort of get that Trojan horse in there. Some people like the word nation. They take a lot of pride in that. Most people, especially Americans, seem to be very nationalistic. But anyways, so.
Yeah, no, I do understand the objection. And it's an important point to make as well, because it's an important clarification. And perhaps this is a flaw in the name. I mean, perhaps it would have been better if the movement was called People of Sanity or something like that, you know. To avoid that. I mean, the other thing about just one more point to defend the term nations in the title is, say, for example, unless you were to achieve a worldwide revolution, like unless you're able to create a revolution where all the countries in the world, the whole world simultaneously converted to a free society, what you're probably going to get is it happening nation at a time, or maybe a few nations at a time or something like that? So you're probably going to have a situation, assuming that any countries convert to a free society, but you're probably going to have a situation where there's going to be some countries in the world that are still statist and some countries that are moving over to free societies. And in that situation, they literally would be the nations of sanity or nations of free society. So, I mean, also other things will become clear as we sort of go into more detail with regards to how nations would be, identified and stuff. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing about a free society that prohibits people from identifying, you know, as like say, as English or Russian or whatever. Obviously certain other aspects of a national, of a nation and a state in particular would disappear. But yeah, I mean, the whole, national identity thing for me is another voluntary thing, and people are free to reject it just as much as they're free to embrace it.
Yeah, I can already see some practical appeal. So speaking of practicality, this regulated market, I'm just going to go ahead and ask questions as they come to me. So one of them is, which I can imagine a lot of people wondering, is police, as well as call them regulations today, whether it's environmental protection or watching out for the rights of, well, anybody, but particularly children or people who are easily victimized, etc. These services of the government are considered universal, at least within a country. You can't really escape them. So this regulated market, if it's voluntary to trade within this sort of this voluntary banner or organization,
I honestly don't know. I find myself not knowing what to refer to, because there's never been a, I mean, to call it a voluntary government would seem like an oxymoron, isn't it? So
there's a word. I don't know what to call it.
There's never been anything like it. Yeah, like a basically like an entity. Best I've come up with.
So what about people who don't care and who are just say you have the worst case scenario? You have people who want to run some kind of human slavery trafficking, which does exist today. How, and of course they're not going to be keen on following any kind of non-aggression principle agreement. They're just going to do what they want, period. And I personally believe that, you know, that's an important question that needs to be answered, is how are we going to prohibit, you know, criminal gangs or criminal underground operations that are engaging in slavery or forced prostitution, things like that? That's a question for any advocate of a free society. But in this instance, what do you see as potentially a solution to that problem? If people are just going to ignore this whole non-aggression principle, say, yeah, whatever, I'm going to do what I want.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the best way to answer that is to introduce the non-aggression agreement. And just briefly talk about this. Basically, the Nations of Sanity presents, they call it the Sanity Agreement, but they also say it could also be referred to as the Non-Aggression Agreement. The reason for the two names is Sanity Agreement is obviously linked to the Nations of Sanity and specific to that movement. The Non-Aggression Agreement is a bit more of a generic term, and the reason why that might be a preferable term for this agreement is that, you know, even if the Nations of Sanity doesn't become anything in regards to people's regards to entering the zeitgeist and becoming, into entering people's awareness. Even if that doesn't happen, it would be nice for the agreement itself to. So it'd be nice for it, perhaps better for it to have a generic name. But anyway, it's split up into four parts. And if I just run through them, because this kind of answers that question. Part one is the basic agreement. So basically what the non-aggression agreement is, it's the non-aggression principle, but in the form of an agreement. And the reason for presenting this is the Nations of Sanity basically promote this as kind of, this is a way that we could peacefully bring about a free society by just getting people to opt to vote for it, to opt for it, you know, whether it was democratically decided. Yeah, our governments, most of them, currently run on the pretense of that they're democratically elected. So an obvious way to peacefully overthrow a government would be to democratically unelect them, for want of a better description. And one way to do that would be to get people to agree to this non-aggression agreement. Anyway, it's built into four parts. The part one is the basic agreement. So if everyone agreed to part one, then that would just basically mean that everyone's agreeing to the non-aggression principle. We're agreeing that the non-aggression principle should be the law. And that's the basic principle. So once you've got that basic agreement, you're understanding that taxation is theft. You're understanding that the only laws that are moral are laws against causing harm or loss to another, which would be things like theft, murder, rape, assault, destruction or trespass of property, and threats or attempts to any of the above. So that would cover that, but it doesn't define any specific lines. For example, it's saying that an adult has full freedom under the non-aggression principle to put what they want in their body and all of this, but it's not saying, you know, exactly, it's not defining an adult. It's not saying where the line is that a child becomes an adult. It's, you know, saying that force is theft and that, sorry, that force is a violation of the non-aggression principle, like if you were to physically assault someone, but it's not drawing the standards. And again, all these different definitions aren't being standard. So part one is just the basic agreement of the non-aggression principle. Then part two is called lines in the sand. Now, what that is basically saying it's not drawing the exact line. It's not setting the exact standards, but just to use, the adult thing again, it's basically saying, okay, we're not deciding exactly when a child becomes an adult, but we're drawing the limits of our agreeing to disagree. So the non-aggression principle has the black and white and it has the gray area. The black and white is the basic, you know, if you're definitely not causing harm, then you're definitely not violating the non-aggression principle. And if you definitely are causing harm to somebody, then you definitely are violating the non-aggression principle. But in between those two standards, there's a gray area where there could be debate over whether people could agree or disagree about whether it's really a violation of the non-aggression principle. So part two isn't drawing the exact line, but it's drawing the limit. So with regards to, say, deciding what age someone becomes an adult, we're not setting an exact age, but we're saying these are the limits. We won't let you go below this age and we won't let you go above this age. So let's say, for argument's sake, we said the black and white limits are 14 to 21, which means we might think that you become an adult at the age of 18, but we accept that it's not an objective line. It's not a standard that we can say that's black and white. You're definitely a child below that age and you're definitely an adult above it. There's room to disagree. It's a gray area. But what we're saying is there is a limit to how much we will agree to disagree. And we think someone becomes an adult at 18, but if another person thinks, no, actually, I don't think someone becomes an adult until 16 or whatever, we're not going to accuse them of paedophilia or whatever. We're going to say, okay, we don't agree with that, but you know, we're prepared to sort of limit. But if they say, oh, we think a 7-year-old's an adult, then we're like, no, that's within the realms of black and white. That's definitely not. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm with you so far. Yeah.
Okay, so that's part two. That's basically setting the black and white. So that's basically setting the limits of where we will not agree to disagree, where we're saying, no, this is definitely a violation of the non-aggression principle. Then part three is setting the standards for society. So going back to the age of consent thing, if part two is saying, right, 14 to 21 is the range that you can maneuver within when deciding when someone becomes an adult. But for part three, we want a consistent standard that people, you know, people want to be part of a society that's got consistent standards. So part three would be about the exact line. So that would be, say, for example, saying, right, we're saying 17 is the age that someone goes from a child to an adult. And that's the standard that we want consistently in our society. That's part three. Now, the one difference with part three to all the other parts of this agreement is part three is voluntary. Part three only applies to people that are agreeing. So say, for example, in England, we had a free society and the people of England still wanted to join together in like a voluntary collective, for want of a better word. They would have to have they'd obviously have to have part one, which is basically the, you know, the basic agreement, but they'd need part two and part three. They'd need part three would be their exact standards that they're all agreeing to, but those standards would only apply to people that agree to be part of that society. So they might say, like, you know, if you want to be part of this collective, this voluntary collective of people, then you have to agree to these specific standards. So you're only tied to the standards of part three if you agree, like a contract. Whereas part two, it doesn't matter if you've agreed to it or not. Part two applies to everybody. Part two is, it's called the lines in the sand because it's literally the lines in the sand. It's the line that we're drawing, which is the limit of our tolerance for other people disagreeing with our standards. So, you know, like I say, it's where we're saying that's the black and white.
Yeah. So I get it. I'm with you.
Okay. And then part four, because I think, well, we've got part one, part two, part three is basically defining the non-aggression principle. Part one, the basic, part two, the black and white, and part three being the standards within the gray. Part four deals with rightful ownership because it's all very well having a non-aggression principle that supports and defends property rights, but if we don't agree on who owns what, then property rights don't become very useful. So that's basically the four parts of the non-aggression principle, or sorry, the non-aggression agreement. And basically the ethos is if you had all of those four parts, if people could come together on all of those four parts, that kind of covers all the bases. Part one is kind of the basic agreement. And that's what we're trying to sort of, you know, throw at people first. But once you've got everyone to agree in principle to the non-aggression principle, you then have to deal with these standards and definitions. And that's what part two, three, and four are about. Obviously with part four defining rightful ownership. Now, how that would apply with the scenario that, from your original question about, well, what would you do about people in society that didn't want to abide by certain standards? Well, the answer to that is the non-aggression principle applies to people whether they agree to it or not. So
yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because it is a universal truth that, you know, your agreement is not necessary for you to still be bound by its legitimacy.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's why I often say, like, when people say, oh, well, if you have government, how are you going to have laws? I'm like, well, if you're having laws that are based on the non-aggression principle, you don't need a government for that because you don't need the authority to rule. Right now, even in today's society, people can make citizens arrest for real crimes, for crimes like, you know, if I saw someone trying to rape someone, I'm allowed to use force to stop them. Mm. I mean, to a certain degree, we recognize that right even in today's society.
Right.
So in a free society, that would just be a given. And the police, for want of a better word, that would operate in a free society would not have to have a higher authority than any normal citizen.
Right.
Because everyone has the right to enforce the non-aggression principle. Now, for example, England became a free society. Part one of the non-aggression agreement would apply to everybody, whether they agree to it or not. And part two would also apply to everybody, whether they agree to it or not, because that is, as I say, that's the black and white. That's the lines in the sand. That's when people are saying,
if I could interject real quick. So part two is sort of just a way to document and centralize, and make it universally understood that, we believe these are the bounds of the basically giving shape and definition to the non-aggression principle, right? Like where the rubber meets the road. For example, the age of consent. Here's what we're willing to tolerate. And, you know, that obviously is open to interpretation, but just for a matter of documentation's sake and clarity's sake, it's kind of like, it reminds me of, these ISO standards or anybody who works in the technical world knows there's all kinds of these voluntary standards that people sort of demand compliance with, whether it's ASTM, that's American Standard Testing Methods, or ISO standards. So those are just scientific, objective documents which say, like, hey, if you want to do business with us, your factory has to meet these requirements. You have to meet this safety standard. So it's just kind of something that actually has objective form to it. Would that be kind of a accurate analogy.
Basically, what you were referring to with regards to, like, when people agree to do business, they have to agree to certain standards. That would be more like part three of the non-aggression agreement, where you've got standards that only apply to people that agree to them. Whereas part two, like I say, applies to people whether they agree or not. So, like, for example, with the age of consent thing, like, say, for example, England was a free society and the people in England basically democratically decided that the age of consent should be 18. And anyone who turns 18, that's when people become an adult. But that's their own specific standard. That's a standard that they've voluntarily opted to. And that would only apply to people that have agreed to be part of that particular collective or society or whatever you want to call it. So it wouldn't apply to people that don't, if someone said, someone who lived in England said, I don't want to be part of this society, I don't want to agree to that standard. They're like, okay, you don't have to. And for you, the age of consent doesn't have to be 18. But there is a limit to how high and how low you can go. There's a limit to how much we will let you just agree to disagree. And let's say, for argument's sake, people decided that they wanted that limit to be 14 to 21. Basically, what they're saying is people that agree to be part of our society, they have to agree to 17 or 18 or whatever we decide the age is. But we won't go to war with people if they want to have a society where the age of consent is 16 or if the age of consent is 20. We're not going to go to war with them over that level of disagreement. But if they start declaring 8-year-olds adults so that, you know, they can have sex with them or something like that, then they're paedophiles as far as we're concerned. They've gone through the threshold of what we would tolerate. They're in the black and white area. And that's why part two I call it the lines in the sand because I feel like it is. It's the lines and it's the limits to what we will. Don't step over this line.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Otherwise, we'll use force. Does that make sense?
Yeah. There's always gray areas, but then there's definitely those situations where it's like, yep, I know this is right or this is totally wrong. And it's the same thing. We were actually just had a call recently about child abuse. And, you know, there's definitely a gray area. There's kids who you know are doing just fine and kids who you know are being abused and all the kids who are somewhere in between where the parents really suck and they're kind of neglecting their kids, but it's ambiguous as to whether you're justified in, you know, taking those kids away from the parents. It's a tough decision, but, okay. So my next question is, why is this agreement? And I have my own ideas or thoughts as to why it might be useful, but what is the benefit to having this kind of larger, more in, what's the word I'm looking for? It's almost sounds like a voluntary government to me, and it had never occurred to me that might be one way to achieve order in a society. I sort of assumed it would always be very decentralized with competing police agencies, competing courts, etc. But this sort of sounds like a bigger umbrella for a society that maybe this is a more concise, simpler, easier way for a society to achieve freedom than having, you know, lots of different competing companies. So I'm trying to figure out what's the benefit of this approach? Why does this approach, would it be more likely? Does it make more sense? You know, what is the appeal? Mm-hmm. As opposed to the sort of purely decentralized, spontaneous order kind of approach. Does that make sense? Or am I even thinking about this right?
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. I mean, to my mind, the main advantage is it's providing a bit of clarity. Now, I mean, for example, under what the Nations of Sanity proposes, there's nothing to stop you having, you know, private, for want of a better word, police forces, and there's nothing stopping that. There's nothing stopping. I mean, it doesn't have to be a simple choice of regulated market or unregulated market. It could be regulated market through this, you know, centralized collective, or it could be like an alternative regulated market that's regulated by a private company. You know, there's nothing stopping the other, but I think the thing is, I mean, things like private police force scares a lot of people. The idea of a private police force mm-hmm. scares a lot of people. And I think partly with good reason. I think people think, well, hang on a minute. If all the police forces are private, then there won't be any consistent standard. And then there's obviously the concern that only people that can afford it would have the protections and things like that. The idea of, I mean, cause like I say, people don't have to have, you know, like this regulated government and this centralized system, people don't have to have it, but I've spoken to enough people to get the idea that people want that. So if people want that, then, you know, and if enough people want that, then they can form together to have that. You know, like there's a chapter in The Nation of Sanity called Voluntary Socialism, which might seem like an oxymoron.
No, it's all sort of coming together now. Now that you mention that, it's all making sense. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
But
if I could just sort of represent the person who's not familiar, what it's sounding like to me is you get, as with voluntary socialism, like me, I would never want a part of that. I mean, forced socialism's god awful, as we know. But voluntary socialism, I still don't like the concept of collective ownership, even if it's voluntary and legitimate. You know, same thing with business partners. I don't like that arrangement, but people are free to do it. So it sounds like you're giving people kind of a more familiar product where you get all the trappings and conveniences of a state without the coercive nature. So, you know, kind of the one thing I think would probably be some democratic choice making, but again, it's a voluntary democracy and you can opt out at any time. So, so people who want to have a more, I guess democratic would be the word. I am not a huge fan of it, but I'm all for voluntary associations. If people find a more expedient, better, more efficient way to do something, you know, there's nothing wrong with the concept of voting as long as you're not forcing people into that scenario against their will. Like you can have companies who vote, you know, the board of directors votes or the shareholders vote, and that's totally fine. There are definitely benefits to having an expedient organization of people who all agree to abide by the same standards. Like what if you want safety for a certain product? People will say, like, oh yeah, we're part of the voluntary standards XYZ. You know, we guarantee that our products meet these standards and nobody forced us to be in this, but we know that our consumers want it. So that's sort of the image that's coming up in my mind.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, it's like that. I mean, to be honest, this is where the regulated market comes in for me as well, because like a lot of people that I've spoken to, they want a regulated market. And I'm like, okay, well, if people want a regulated market, then there's no reason. And to be honest, moving from our current system into a free society, we already have the infrastructure set up for a regulated market because we already have a regulated market. So in many ways, it would be very easy to provide that regulated market because it's already there. All you would really do in a free society is you would decriminalize the black market. You would decriminalize unregulated trade, so people aren't obliged to use the regulated market. But there's a lot of reasons why people would want to use the regulated market, you know, things like consumer protection, you know, guarantee certain safety standards that they know that, you know, companies that trade within the regulated market have to adhere to. And obviously, and the extra cost that they're paying, that's currently duty taxes that would, you know, become regulation fees under a free society, they're basically paying to have that regulation provided.
Right. Yes. This makes perfect sense to me so far. And for a lot of people, it's very hard to imagine a free society, like extremely hard. You know, people get hung up on the roads. Who's going to build the roads? So this would be, maybe if nothing else, like, I don't know if it is a sustainable model or if it's a transition model, but at the very least, when people ask the question, so how would we have, you know, all the things we get from government today? You can say, well, you can have a voluntary government. You just can't steal. You don't get to impose a violent monopoly, but you can have your government today exactly as it looks like, other than the theft and the coercion and the imposition of rules against people who didn't agree to them. And I think that comforts a lot of people to say, oh yeah, we can have all this just without the evil, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the reasons, just to talk about like names, it's one of the reasons why I've said to you before about, I'm not keen on identifying as an anarcho-capitalist. Not because I have any problem with the, like I say, I'm pretty much am an anarcho-capitalist, but it's the capitalist part of the title. Cause for me, I understand that capitalism is fully compatible with a free society, which is why so many anarchists identify as anarcho-capitalists, because that's the economic system that they know will work in a free society. But for me, it's not a defining quality. That's why I don't like it in the name, because for me, the defining part is the voluntary part. As far as I'm concerned, if someone, you know, the nation's sanity is open to people that might detest capitalism, that might want to just only be involved in socialist style societies. As long as it's a voluntary form of socialism, they're free to carry on as they are. They don't have to submit to any particular economic system. They just don't get to impose their economic system onto others.
Yeah, that's why I like the term voluntarism. It's more of an all-encompassing umbrella term. And, you know, then of course you get the debate between communists or anarcho-communists, as they call themselves, who don't even recognize private property, but that's, you know, an entirely different debate. But now that we've sort of defined this nations of sanity concept, which I think is pretty useful and interesting and something I never quite considered, let's switch gears here if we could. I know that you have some critiques or concerns, we could say, about the pure anarcho-capitalist or even just the pure anarchist viewpoint. You know, how would we manage property? Is everything ownable? Can you privatize everything? So you have a few concerns, is my understanding. And what do you say we just jump into them and sort of address them one by one?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a few issues, some of which I've got some sort of proposed solutions for, and some of which I don't have any solution for, which is why I'd like to pick the brains of a fellow anarcho-capitalist who might be able to help me, or might even just be able to empathize with the situation of there not being a clear answer. But I mean, one of the biggest problems, and this is something that part four of the non-aggression agreement will deal with, is ownership. And one of the biggest problems is deciding rightful ownership. Now, obviously, I'm on board with the basic anarcho-capitalist ethos of things like homesteading. For me, that seems like a perfectly reasonable way to claim ownership. I mean, then obviously we've got the voluntary trade. So, you know, someone legitimately sells you in a voluntary trade their land to you and all that. That's fine. The problem we have is most of the land and most of the resources today that is currently owned was at least originally acquired through violations of the non-aggression principle. Not necessarily most recently, you know, like people that own land now didn't acquire it that way. They might have bought it from someone who also acquired it legitimately, who bought it from someone who also, but eventually if you go back far enough, someone stole that land. And one thing that anarcho-capitalists don't provide is an answer to, well, how do you deal with that? Do you know, how do you, it's a little bit like, and again, the nation sanity does to suggest an answer for how you deal with government property, but government property is another example. All government property has been stolen. Cause that's all government does is steal. So, so you've obviously got an issue for that. Now the nation's sanity does provide a potential answer with regards to how you would, designate ownership of what the government currently claims ownership over. But that still leaves the problem of private ownership and the fact that a lot of that has obviously, been gained through illegitimate means. And then also there is the limits of private ownership. And as I say, there is certain areas where private ownership of something seems immoral because that particular resource doesn't seem like it is owned by anybody. Therefore, how can anybody, you know, it's a little bit like how, you know, anarchists, we like to point out that, you know, that people can't delegate rights to the state that they don't have. We don't have the right to initiate force on people, yet we delegate that right to the state, even though we don't have the right to delegate it. And in a similar kind of way, we have the issue of, with regards to property, we don't have the right to steal property from people, but a lot of property has been acquired that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And another thing that comes to my mind is how to dissolve the government, because clearly that's just a frothy mix of theft all around. And, you know, you've got tax money that's been funneled through corporatist schemes, and definitely just unfairness all around. And it's more or less impossible to track, like, where has my tax money gone? Like, if we were to get rid of the government, what do we do with all of its resources? How are they going to be distributed? But, you know, same concept. And I don't think we'll ever unravel all the messes. I mean, obviously it's preferable if you can go back and right all the wrongs. So let's start with a really simple example. Say somebody stole your car, and then that car was then sold to somebody who had no idea that it was stolen. Obviously, if you can catch that person the next day, say, hey, I'm sorry, this car was stolen. I know that you didn't do anything wrong, but the car is legitimately mine, and you can't have it. In my mind, what has to happen is the person who sold the third party the car, they now owe them reparations for that, because, hey, you sold me something that was stolen. So, you know, and now somebody's calling me and telling me I can't have it. At the very least, you have to reimburse that person, right? The thief now has a duty to pay the person who he sold the car to, because they can't have the car, right?
Yeah.
So to at least establish how ideally a situation would work. Now, of course, you and I both know that's pretty much never going to happen with a lot of stolen land and government property. So we can try to approximate that solution, even though we'll never get there, like, you know, however much you paid in taxes. But then there's the question of, well, how much value did you extract from the government? So I don't know that we'll ever unravel that mess. And it may be even more destructive to have to kind of throw all property rights into question now and have to consider, you know, redistribution. So there's a lot of practical challenges. I'm not quite sure how we would address those, or if it's even worth, you know, what if we draw a line and we say, you know what, the crimes of the past, if the people are dead, those crimes are gone. We'll do our best to address, you know, active illegitimacies and right those wrongs. But a lot of these things which go back generations and generations, I don't know that it's even worth it to open those. What do you think about
that? Yeah, I agree. And to be honest, I think your analogy is perfect as well with regards to the stolen bike, because that's exactly how it is. You've got an issue where, I mean, basically in this analogy you gave, the person who stole the bike and sold it on, essentially he stole from two people. He stole from the person, you know, who he actually stole the bike from, but he also stole from the person he sold the bike to, because he sold them something that wasn't theirs, which means he basically defrauded them out of their money.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And for me, that's a perfect analogy for what we're talking about. And that is the problem. I actually think, the Nations of Sanity does provoke, it proposes a potential solution to deal with what's government owned, but it does fall short when it comes to dealing with what's privately owned. And the reason why I think government ownership is easier to deal with than private ownership, because I agree with you. I think you've got to draw a line. There's a point where, both from a practical point of view, but also a moral point of view, there's a limit to how far you can go back with regards to righting wrongs. You know, for example, not only would it be impractical to say, for example, give the United States of America back to the Native Americans and tell everyone else to leave. Not only would that be impractical, but I think it would also be immoral, because the people that live there now had no part in the stealing of the lands and all
exactly.
the rest of it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And they acquired it legitimately. So that's a genuine problem. And I think it's a bigger problem with private ownership. The reason why I think it's a bigger problem with private ownership than with government is because I think, this is the solution that the Nations of Sanity proposes. And again, this is a proposal, not part of the demands, but it's, you know, it's a suggestion. And this is based on the idea that the one thing that makes government easier to deal with is everything that government owns is illegitimate. You know, like with private ownership, you know, that you could debate, you know, for example, if the theft happened recently, You know, you can deal with it better than if it was like 300-400 years ago. But the one thing with government is it's all theft. Now, returning it to its rightful owners is a bit more difficult because it goes back so far and it's, and I think, I watched a podcast last night. I can't remember which one it was of Flagship Freedom, where you spoke about the fact that government, it's almost as if they done it on purpose. Government have created such a mess that righting all their wrongs. I mean, it's almost like they've, you know, like with creating a welfare class, a dependent class, and all these other aspects, they've created such a mess that they've made it so hard that, that even when we do create a free society, we've got, you know, it's like, have you ever, found like a load of wires that are all tangled up and you've got to try and untangle them? It's, you know, it's kind of like that. But the one thing that I think makes government easier to deal with is it is all theft. Everything government owns is illegitimate, and that's got to go somewhere. If you're going to overthrow the government and dissolve the government, you know, a free society would essentially, by default, be overthrowing the government, even though you're retaining, you know, many of the qualities and services and what have you. You're actually getting rid of that entity as a ruling body. But there's a lot of resources and there's a lot of land that's owned by government, what's currently called public. Now, one of the things the Nations of Sanity proposes is the best way to sort of designate that, and this is, again, this is just a suggestion, but I quite like it, and I'd like you to sort of pick holes out of it, is, say, for example, we did it in England. So we overthrew the government in England, and we introduced the non-aggression agreement, part one, part two, part three, part four. What we would do is we would say, right, the government has stolen from its citizenry, and one suggestion is to make the entire nation almost shareholders, like almost turn the government into a private company almost. So all of its resources, and then have them owned, equally by the whole citizenry. So it's almost like we're all shareholders in, you know, what was the nation of England. We're all shareholders of that. Now, we can continue to have this government run, but in a voluntary form. Or we can opt out of that. We can say, well, I don't want any part of this. I'll take my shares.
Yeah,
I'll cash out. Yeah, that's a perfect term. Yeah, I'll cash out. I don't want any part of it. But I'll take my share of what's deemed to be rightfully mine. And I can't think of a better way and a more fairer way to do it. I mean, I think there's certain things that would need to be addressed before you start divvying things up. I think there's certain things that would need to be addressed immediately. And there's perhaps a certain amount that can be returned to its rightful owners, you know, because it's that recently been stolen or whatever. But I think when you cut off and you say, right, well, we can't untangle these wires any more than this. This is the cutoff point. I think everything else, you could divide it up to people. People could cash out, but also, as well as being shareholders of this, for want of a better word, company that was once a government, in addition to being shareholders of this, everyone would have an equal vote in it. And that's why this entity would be like it would be completely voluntary. It would have no ruling authority over anybody. But it can be democratically controlled. So you could still have the nation of England, the what was once a government, could still exist in a voluntary form. It could still be democratically controlled, and the citizenry can basically collectively own it, for want of a better word, and the land and resources, obviously minus anybody that's decided to cash out of that system. And that would be, in my opinion, a good way of dealing with that issue. It doesn't solve the private property issue. And I think for the most part, I think we probably would have to just draw a line, as you say, and just say, look, you know, going back enough generations, this property was acquired legitimately. There's no practical way to return it to rightful owners of 1,000 years ago or whatever. And, you know, and you just draw a line under it. But I think with government, I think you can say, right, well, we might not be able to return it all to its rightful owner, but it is all definitely theft. It's all definitely stolen property. And what to do with that stolen property is a little bit like, I mean, if you just bear with me, one metaphor I like is, I kind of think of it as, I imagine this big slave fortress And say you go and you liberate the slaves, you overthrow the slave drivers, you kick them out, and you free the slaves. Those slaves, that there might be loads of treasure that their slave masters have managed to acquire off the backs of those slaves. We don't know what slaves have worked harder than who, and we, you know, we can't designate it exactly. So we just give it to them all equally. We say, right, slaves, you now own this fortress. You now own the wealth because it was stolen from you in the first place.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. And my only concern, again, is, as you already just mentioned, is, you know, some people have paid into this system their whole lives. Some people just started paying. So, yeah, you know, some people you may want to designate, you know, based on how much taxes you've paid. And then, of course, the question is, well, how voluntary was it? Some people are very happy with paying taxes to the state. Other people want, you know, no part of it. I don't know how you could ever quantify that. I don't think you can. So the only clarification I would make is potentially have it dependent on how much you've paid in. I think that's pretty fair as you're ever going to get. And one of the challenges is appealing to, especially folks from the left, they're always about starting from an equal point. And if there's any inequality or any unfairness whatsoever of opportunity to them, that's like, oh, yep, that's the deterministic nature of the system. It's unfair. The wealth is always going to stay in the hands of the wealthy, just not based on any kind of work ethic or value that they created. It's all just based on unfair advantage. And for them, you know, that's the convenient explanation for the current distribution of wealth in society. So some people you're never going to please. They're going to say, oh yeah, you know, you're just a billionaire class from the dissolution of the government and it wasn't fairly done. I'm personally a believer that if you were to dissolve society right now and give 90% of the wealth to the poorest 10% of people, you'd probably see that money go right back to where it started in a matter of 10 years. You know, I believe the distribution of wealth in society is highly or mostly dependent on people's life choices. And, you know, as you probably know, there's a constant churning of societal standing and your class standing, so to speak, and your amount of property and wealth. But anyways, that's just a side note. You know, I hate when people can't accept that your point in life has something to do with, you know, your responsibility and your choices. It's not just the card or the hand that you've been dealt. But I agree with your approach, more or less. The practical question of how to distribute government resources once it's all the house of cards falls. But I'm also not entirely concerned with it at the end of the day anyways. You know, it's going to happen. It's going to be unjust. There's war. There's conflict. There's theft. And we have to – one thing I don't want, which people often do, is they say, well, we can't have freedom because we can't get over this stupid little threshold. It's like just, you know, rip the Band-Aid off. Whatever it's going to be will be a memory 5 years from now anyways. So just do it, you know. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, just touching on the you know, people sort of in charge of what they achieve, I think for the most part that's true. I mean, I think we obviously have to recognize that there is a discrepancy between opportunities, and it's not 100% what you know, people's own effort. You know, some people are in a bad situation through no fault of their own. And I mean, one of the things that I like to remind a lot of my left-leaning friends is a lot of the injustices that they complain about were created by the state.
Yes.
So, you know, so, I mean, that's one issue but then you could argue, well, whatever's to blame, the situation is the situation. I think you're right. I mean, I think there would be exceptions to what you're saying. I think, you know, there are obviously inequalities that have been created, as I say, by the state. But, I think, you know, there are issues. But I think for the most part, you know, even people that are in bad situations, a lot of them manage to rise out of that somehow. And then people that were given relative advantage descend, you know, down if they don't work hard and stuff. So I think, I mean, I think, I don't think they're completely without any point when they talk about.
Oh yeah, no, I absolutely.
But I think that they go too far. Because the problem is, and they go too far like ANCOMs go too far. They get to the point where they dissolve people of any responsibility. Exactly. And I would say that 90% of what happens to us is down to us. But then there is also factors that are beyond our control. We obviously have to accept and understand that. I can understand where they're coming from, but again, it's like what we're talking about. There's a limit to what you can do. And like when people talk to me about, don't you think people should, because the thing is, I do sympathize with a lot of the things that a lot of lefties want. When people say, don't you think that we should have, we have an NHS in England, a National Health Service, and a lot of people in England are very, proud of it, very protective of it. They want that. And I can understand that. I can understand that, we want a health service where people can, I can understand the ethos behind it. My issue with it is it doesn't matter how virtuous that might be. Some people might disagree with it. Some people might say, well, no, I don't even think that's a good thing to have. But whether you think it's a good thing to have or not, the problem with it now is people are being forced to pay for it. If enough people wanted to get together to provide a health service that provided people with free healthcare, there's no reason why that shouldn't happen, but they have to voluntarily contribute to such a thing. They don't get to force other people into it. And it's like a little bit like when it comes to distributing government wealth. I think in certain aspects, to a certain degree, you can return to people what's been stolen from them in proportion to what's been stolen from them. But then there is also a limit to how far you can go back. There is a limit to what wrongs you can right, what things you can undo. And that's where I think once you've reached the limit of those issues and you've dealt with those aspects, that's when you would then say, right, well, everything else, we'll just divide that equally amongst the citizenry, and we'll just say we've all been equally screwed, even though we haven't all been equally screwed, but we can't, there's a limit to how much we can disseminate exactly who's been screwed how much and who's owed what and what have you. There is a limit to that, and when you reach that limit, I think that's when you just have to basically decide, right, well, what's left just gets divided equally amongst everybody, even though that probably means a lot of people are going to get something that they might have spent their whole life never contributing to anything, mm-hmm. and only ever taking, and they might still end up with a little payday at the end of it just because they're part of the citizenry. There is a limit to how much you can restore to rightful ownership, because because it's been through the government mixer and it's such a mess, and it's, as I say, it's like that metaphor of the tangled wires. There's only so much you can untangle before you've got to say, okay, right, the rest is just everybody's. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a shame. I hate theft. I hate it down to the very last penny. And if someone were to mug $20 from me today, I'd never forget it and I would be furious. But the government robs probably in the hundreds of dollars from me every day. So, you know what? It sucks, but I am not going to be a money miser. I'd be happy if we end the state and, I can move on with my life and just, whatever. And you are absolutely right to your point before. There are people who are genuinely unfair situations or things that were outside of the control, and we should do our best to address that. And that's the great thing about voluntary charity, is that, people can contribute based on who they believe deserves, so to speak, your assistance. But anyways, I think that's as...
And sorry, also one other thing I'd like to add is, another thing about it is like for example, just take the health service. Like, say everyone wanted to provide healthcare. Well, I have two answers to people say, well, we wouldn't have National Health Service in a free society. I'm like, well, if enough people wanted it, then you could contribute to it. And remember, all you people aren't being forced to contribute to anything else. So, like, all the people that want the National Health Service but don't necessarily want to contribute to other things that they're currently being forced to contribute to might be more inclined to contribute to the National Health Service if that's something that they believe in and want. And they might be more inclined to it by the fact that they're not being forced to pay for other things. right. if that makes sense. Right. And also, if enough of them democratically decide to, they can use part of the funds that are acquired through the regulated market to provide a safety net of funding for things like that. Again, that would be up to them.
Right. Yep. I totally agree. These are as fair and even-handed approaches as any reasonable person could expect. So I doubt we're going to get any better a solution to dealing with a fair transition to a free society is what we laid out. I think it's pretty good.
Thank you. But yeah, no, I do think it's, I mean, the thing is, I think it's important that we acknowledge, you know, like when we were talking about, like, we do need to acknowledge the injustices. I think I think it's important to point out that these are crimes committed by the state. You know, obviously the biggest crime of the left, or the biggest mistake the left make, is to blame it all on capitalism. You know, one of the things that kind of made me shake my head a little bit, with like the Occupy movement was how anti-capitalist it was. And I was kind of like, well, you're kind of missing the point. You know, you're kind of missing the point. Right. If you think that capitalism is the problem. And again, like I say, I'm not saying they have to love capitalism. You know, for me, it's about voluntarism. It's not about capitalism. I understand how most voluntarists recognize free trade as something that's very obviously compatible with a free society. But as I say, voluntary collectives, voluntary forms of socialism are also compatible with a free society. They might not be very efficient, but it doesn't kind of matter, because the people that opt for them will find out how efficient they are. And the people that don't, like yourself, who don't want any part of something, aren't going to be forced to be involved with them.
The Occupy Wall Street movement, that is just one example of, oh God, it's now that we've sort of stepped outside that bubble and we can look inside, we see how very confusing it can be, because they have some great points about, you know, corporatism. That is a very much unjust transfer of wealth. You know, the theft of taxes going towards corporate welfare. But like you said, they also tend to hate capitalism and private property, which I would argue are totally legitimate things. Similarly, what I'm trying to say is politics really clouds a lot of issues. The war on drugs, you know, we're not advocating for drugs. We're just saying the prohibition of drugs is wrong and the theft to fund those is wrong. So, the state takes a lot of, what's the word? It takes conflicts and just makes them really, really confusing and unmanageable for people. Like, most people have a lot more in common than they would think, you know, the left versus right. It's not that, you know, you can hardly say, you know, I don't like Trump and people assume that you love Hillary Clinton. So, you know, that's one of the problems, just an observation that I've had, that once I've stepped outside that paradigm, it brings a huge amount of clarity. But anyways, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, no, but that's a good point, though, because, I mean, one of the things I've heard about, I mean, obviously anarchism or anarcho-capitalism, it sort of comes out of libertarianism. And I've heard libertarianism described as being economically right and socially left. I would kind of argue that it's not either, but it is closer to the left socially and closer to the right economically. I'd say it goes further in both directions than both sides do. But obviously there's a common ground with people on the left over things like drugs. You know, most people on the left are against drug laws, because are more for social freedoms, you know, just as a generalization. I realize there are exceptions, just as there's many people on the right that are also against drug laws, but stereotypically, right wing has often been associated with a more authoritarian attitude to things like that. People on the right have often supported drug laws. But yet they have more in common with libertarians when it comes to economic issues and trade and capitalism and things like that. So I think it's about bridging that gap, and it's about finding the common ground. And again, one of the sort of hooks of the Nations of Sanity, and the reason why it's saying, well, let's all unite on a common ground, which we, you know, identify as sanity. And it's like, well, because people on the right do recognize liberty in certain contexts, but they're not consistent with it. And then people on the left, same, they'll recognize liberty in a certain context, but then they're not consistent with it and they don't apply it to other areas. And what we're basically saying is, well, if the thing about morality is it has to be consistent. If you're going to say that theft is wrong, then you have to admit that it's wrong for you as well to steal. It's not just wrong for you to be stolen from. You know, it's about applying something consistency. And one of the things about the non-aggression principle, one of the reasons why we sort of talk about it as being just a standard of sanity and a standard of true equality is because it applies equally to everybody. You know, it's the same rule for one person as for another. And one of the biggest problems in the world today, and it's a problem that both, I think people on the left and people on the right would agree with this characterization. One of the biggest problems of the world today is the injustice, is the inequality, not the inequality of outcome and or even the inequality of opportunity, but the inequality of rights. The fact that there are some people that have no rights, some people that have rights that they shouldn't have. You know, like a government claims the right to rule over us. No one should have that right. And then we don't even have the right to decide what we put in our body. Like you say, opposing the drug law isn't about saying drugs are great. You don't have to advocate. You could be 100% against drugs, but you recognize that it's immoral to have a law that criminalizes people for doing drugs because they own themselves. It's no one's business what they put in their body. And, Penn Jillette, the magician guy? I don't agree with him on everything, but I think he did sum up quite well because he's kind of a libertarian. And he did sum up quite well because he said he doesn't do any drugs, including legal ones. He doesn't even drink alcohol or drink caffeine, you know, which is also a drug. But he says, I'm totally against drugs, but as a libertarian, I'm totally against drug laws. Because they're immoral and you don't need to do a drug or even like a drug to, I mean, I've always been throughout my life, I've been a heavy, advocate for legalizing cannabis or ending the law against cannabis. And I've always approached it from the point of view of, well, cannabis is different to other drugs. It's not as dangerous. There's tremendous medical value. So keeping it illegal is immoral for those reasons. But then as I got older, I kind of realized that although that is true, all drug laws are immoral. Because even if the drug was a terrible drug, even if it was, you know, a drug that you absolutely hated and had no medical value, it's still someone's choice if they want to take it. And it's still someone's choice if they want to buy or sell it. If they're an adult of sound mind and body, you know, it's a little bit different with children. Just one little point I'd like to make on children of free society, because I do get asked this question quite a lot when they say, well, what about with children? You know, like when we talk about the freedom, particularly when the subject of drugs come up, would it be legal to trade drugs? And I'd be like, well, of course, if it's voluntary trade. And it's like, oh, so people can just sell drugs to children. I'm like, well, hang on a minute.
Right.
What you've got to understand is the rights that the non-aggression principle gives us are given to adults. And the reason why they're given to adults is because adults can enter into an agreement. They can enter into a contract. So an adult is deemed to be able to enter into legal contracts. And I mean, we kind of have this standard in today's society where, you know, a child isn't allowed to enter into a legal contract because we understand that the child doesn't have enough understanding to be able to make a voluntary choice. And you just use that exact same logic when you look at the non-aggression principle. A child can't consent to drug taking because a child doesn't own itself in the way that an adult does. Just the same as a child can't consent to sex. A child can't enter into a legal contract for the exact same reason. So it's just the same standard that you're applying. The freedom to buy a drug is the same freedom you have to engage in any kind of sexual activity that you want, you know, whether you're a homosexual or a heterosexual or whatever. But that's a right you have as an adult. A child doesn't have that right. I know it sounds like I'm denying children rights, but because what we're saying is that child isn't responsible for themselves. Somebody else is responsible for that child, usually would be a parent or a carer or something like that. I mean, the same would apply, for example, to an adult that had a mental deficiency that made them sort of legally a child. You know, it's the same thing. If we deem that someone is an adult of sound mind and body, then they have full ownership over themselves. They make their own decisions. They can enter into legal contracts and they can make the voluntary decision whether they want to buy and consume a drug. They can make a voluntary decision over who they have sex with and all of that. But a child doesn't own themselves in that same way.
Yes, I agree more or less with what you're saying. And I actually have sort of categorized it as a form of deception, which kind of falls under the umbrella of fraud. Like if you try to get a kid hooked on drugs, you're essentially taking advantage of the fact that they do not have their full mental faculties. And as such, you know, like you said, it's like a retarded person or a mentally challenged person. You're kind of tricking them, even though, you know, it may be voluntary in the moment. We all know kids do not have their full mental capacity with them. So, yeah, I agree fully. And people, they always manage to find, and, you know, it's good to scrutinize these ideas. You know, there are, as a general principle, there are always gray areas. There's always going to be the, well, what about this? What about that? And that's where these principles may break down. Like, for example, people always like to bring up these insane lifeboat scenarios. Like what if a guy was starving in the desert and he just needed a glass of water? Otherwise he was going to die. Would it be okay for him to steal a water bottle from a guy who's selling it for $1 million to exploit the situation? And in that instance, it's like, yeah, I don't care if he steals a water bottle, if it's going to mean his life. Now, I wouldn't universalize that principle because it only represents a tiny, tiny, negligibly small fraction of human interactions. The reason we have principles is because we aren't God. We're not hovering over every situation in life, judging how it should work and the true right and wrong. Like we have the non-aggression principle because in virtually all situations, theft and murder are wrong, and we can give people that common sense arbitration over typical human interaction. You know, what if you had to rape somebody, otherwise the whole world was going to get nuked? What about your morals now? And does that invalidate the non-aggression principle? No, because we're not dealing with like a hard science where the rule applies absolutely 100% of the time. And no method of organizing human society could possibly encapsulate or capture all human situations. So we need to admit that there are shortfalls and difficult situations, but does authoritarianism, does socialism, does any concise human societal system, so to speak, or for lack of a better term, does any cogent way of organizing society address every single situation? No, it doesn't. So we're doing our best to fill in the gaps, you know, and those gaps could be children. They could be how to deal with very scarce resources, which I think was another one of your topics. Perhaps we could touch on that. But,
yeah,
you know, I like to lay out the general principle as well as with, you know, when I'm describing capitalism and free trade, you explain why it works in general. And then all of a sudden you don't have to be a master PhD in how would the roads work and how would healthcare work and how would security work. You realize, oh, wait, voluntary trade and supply and demand, you know, kind of takes care of these things.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing is, I mean, it's a very good point to raise, actually, because the lifeboat scenario is often used to try and debunk, if you like, the non-aggression principle and libertarian and anarchist philosophy. But, I mean, in my mind, it doesn't debunk it because by nature, a lifeboat situation is a life, you know, it's an emergency situation where the kind of rules go out the window. It doesn't mean that theft isn't theft or that theft isn't still wrong or rape isn't still wrong or murder isn't still wrong or, I mean, you know, like an example with like, if I was in some emergency situation, I might break into somebody's house to use their phone or something like that. You know, someone had an accident. I didn't have a phone. It's an emergency situation. It doesn't mean that breaking and entering isn't wrong and it's not a crime. But right. In that situation, it would probably be forgiven because of the extenuating circumstances, because people would agree that you were kind of forced to do it. You know, it almost stops it from being a voluntary action in a way. In if it's that kind of emergency, if it's life or death. You know, if someone puts a gun to your head and makes you do something, the law already recognizes that you didn't really have a choice. And the lifeboat situation is kind of the same scenario. You know, if it's a matter of life and death, and you have to break a law that's a proper law that would be a crime under normal standards, and you've got to break that law because it's a matter of life and death, then I think all of a sudden that doesn't become a willful criminal act. You're kind of being forced into it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It makes sense that, that's where here's how to encapsulate it. Next time somebody tries to do something, just say, okay, you can't disprove the generality with the exception. It's called an exception. You know, we're not disproving F equals MA, you know, physics where you can bring up one little situation where the rule doesn't apply and then the entire rule falls apart. That's not how human society works. So you are basically 100% right. There's nothing.
And also you make the good point that this is a problem that current system doesn't solve either. So it's not like it's not like anarchism is creating a new problem. The absolute best the critic could say is that it's not fixing a problem that already exists.
Yeah.
You know, but as I say, I do think also you can use the argument that in the scenario, in an emergency situation, you're not committing a willful criminal act, and it doesn't invalidate the morality of that law as a general standard. It just means that in certain situations, we might do things that are morally wrong under normal circumstances, but in extreme circumstances when our life is being threatened or somebody else's life is being threatened, certain rules go out the window. Of course they do. That, like you say, that's why it's called an exception. That's why it's called an emergency situation, because it is, it's circumstances that aren't standard.
Yeah. And oftentimes, I mean, look, we are proposing a system that's better. We don't have to prove that it's perfect. Perfect can be the enemy of good sometimes. It'd be, you know, people say, well, we can't have anarchy because it's never been tried. Okay, why hasn't it ever been tried? Well, because idiots like you keep saying, we can't have it because it's never been tried. It's like, you know what? It's way better than what we have now. It's probably one of the best situation or systems we could possibly devise, or lack of a system. So it's not perfect. It just has to be better. It does not have to be perfect.
Exactly. I mean, like I say, and the whole ethos of the Nations of Sanity and the motivation behind the name Sanity is that that's what we're saying. We're not proposing a perfect society. We're not proposing utopia. And as I agree with you, I think that's actually counterproductive to even try to create a utopia, because people are all so different. And if you start trying to create a world that's based on your ideals and your preferences, then you're going to create a world that other people disagree with, because it's not in accordance with their ideals and preferences. That's why we're bringing it back to a basic standard of sanity. We're saying, look, we're not creating a world that's perfect. We're just going to want to create a world that's sane, and we can all move and we can just go from there, you know?
Right.
Because people say that to me all the time when I complain about system. They say, look, you know, the world's not perfect. And I say, I'm not asking for a perfect world. I will settle for sanity. If we put sanity in place, that's it. I'm happy.
Right. Yeah. At least let's agree on what is theft, and let's stop being so ridiculous about it. Like, you know, the left, how concerned they are with consent. Like they've gone so far to the point where if college students don't have like a written contract, you know, that's what some of them have proposed in terms of establishing consent. But, oh, when you get to taxation, it's like, oh, well, no, you see, you live here, and even though it's your private property and the implied consent, it's like, wow, what an incredible double standard. And that is insane. So I agree. If we can at least get to a reasonable starting point, and you know, it's challenging. We have to blast through people's biases. I made the same ridiculous arguments when I was first getting into it and exposed to these ideas. But, you know, that's what we're here for, right? So it's...
Oh, definitely. And I mean, some people, you know, when I'm talking to people, I'm very keen to talk to people about this. I sometimes struggle finding people that want to talk about it, but I'm very keen to talk to people about it. And even people that have these sort of what we would say are almost stupid questions, but I'm glad they ask them, because I think it gives me an opportunity to clarify, and it gives me an opportunity to get rid of some misconceptions. Because I mean, I think a lot of the resistance is down to misconceptions. You know, like I said, about one of the reasons why we wanted to present these ways in which a lot of what a lot of the government services and infrastructure can be retained in a free society is because a common misconception is people just think, right, well, if we don't have government, we won't have any of the things that government provides. And it's like, well, no, you can still have those things. You don't have the ruling, you don't have the oppression, but you can still have the services. You know, as I say, governments don't need to rule us to serve us. They can just serve us. And obviously, it wouldn't be a government anymore. And I think we need to come up with a new name for such an entity, because government pretty much by definition wouldn't exist anymore. But whatever this new entity would be could still provide all the services that government currently provides. It just wouldn't have the power to rule over people and impose on people in the way that governments currently do. So I think it's important to invite these sort of questions. It can be a bit tiresome on our part, because sometimes you feel like you're going through the same thing. I mean, I've had to explain to people that the non-aggression principle is not a pacifist principle more times than I can count. And I've explained that to the same people more than once as well. And friends, you know, people that are intelligent and are actually made the effort to take an interest in what I'm talking about. And like, I've explained it to them, and they'll still sort of say, well, yeah, well, what if someone punched me in the face? And I'm like, well, you can punch him back. You don't have to be Gandhi. You're just not allowed to initiate force on people. And, you know, you're allowed to use force. It's, you know, things like that. It does become tiresome on our part, because we feel like we're just saying the same thing over and over again. And it's because it's not seeking into people. But that's because I think part of that is because the current society is so devoid of this basic sanity, this basic logic, that people, that even though it is quite a simple and quite a basic ethos, it's very alien to people.
Yeah, very well said. And it's tiresome for us because we make the same arguments over and over. And that's what it is whenever you're trying to make a change in society. You know, imagine the people who were arguing against slavery, you know, back in the 1800s or for women's rights. It's like, to them, it's clicked. They got it, and they're ahead of the curve in society. And that's how all social change starts, is you basically dealing with irrationality. And, you know, it can be exhausting. It is absolutely exhausting, but, you know, hopefully future generations will smile upon us one day. I would like to think. Now, I know you have some more, I don't want to say questions or criticism or just thoughts, really. This is two voluntarists, hashing out, you know, the details, the finer points. And, yeah. We should definitely continue. Although we're probably pushing an hour and a half at this point. We may want to cap it off at this episode and potentially continue on. What do you think about that, Matt?
Yeah, I'm more than happy to do that. Yeah, I think it's important not to make them digestible chunks for people
it can be scary take on board. Too.
Yeah. I mean, I'm more than happy to continue this conversation another time. As I say, I love talking about this sort of stuff. And I think it's a very important conversation to have, because I think, you know, like you say, we can't perfect every detail, but I think the more wrinkles we can iron out and the more things that we can clarify, I think is the better, the more chance this sort of movement has of coming to fruition. Because I think we do need to deal with all these aspects, but there is so much to pick through. As I say, the government has created a right old mess, and there are a lot of questions that people have, and it's understandable that they have them. So, yeah, I mean, if you're up for it, I'd love to have another conversation about this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I give you a lot of credit for trying to lay out and doing so quite well. Addressing specific concerns. You know, that's what people want, is reassurance. When you point out a problem, you should have a solution in your back pocket as well. So, where can people find this Nations of Sanity?
The website is nationsofsanity.com. So nice and easy to find. There is a Facebook page as well. There is a Twitter page, but it's currently not being used. So, it's a very small movement, very undermanned, not much manpower behind it at the moment. The strength is in the ideas, not in the size of it at the moment. But yeah, I mean, the main resource would be the website or the Facebook page, both of which are linked to each other anyway. And currently there's just a lot of articles that talk about this, the non-aggression agreement written out and things like that. Hopefully there'll be more content in the form of things like videos and stuff that we're trying to work on. But at the moment, it is just the website.
All right. Fantastic. Well, folks, head over to nationsofsanity.com, and we will be speaking to Matt again in the future. So thank you very much, Matt, for your time. Appreciate the stimulating conversation between two voluntarists. You would call yourself that, right? Is that a fair description?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely a voluntarist.
Fantastic. All right. Well, it's 5:50 a.m. here, so time to start a new day. Good talking to you, Matt, as always, and we'll talk to you soon again.
Okay, thanks, Dan. I enjoyed the conversation. Appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
And that one desire is you. And I know nobody else ain't gonna do.